Opening the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. It's Thursday, April 26th. Public hearing and work session on Department of Human Services, Mental Health and Developmentally Disability Services Division, federal grant application request. Barry Cass and George not. Oh, Dave's here for George. Come on, Dave. See, I remembered it wasn't Mike. Dave.
You're doing very well. Chairwoman.
No, that's not George. I saw him Mike before.
Yeah.
I would remind the subcommittee, I do respond to anything you want to call me, though.
Well, within reason.
Yeah. Hey, you.
Madam Chair, I wish the Department of Administrative Services were as generous with other agencies. Madam Chair, I'm Barry Cast. I'm the Administrator of Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. We greatly appreciate bringing this forward this morning. It's a request to apply for a three-year federal grant, $20,000 per year, to assist the division in planning for community-based services in response to the Olmstead decision of the United States Supreme Court in June of 1999, which addressed the ADA requirements as they relate to the treatment of people with serious mental illness in state hospitals. As you know, Oregon is facing litigation in this area. We do have some plans for bringing forward a long-term plan that would address this issue. And the purpose of the federal grant is to give us the resources to convene a coalition of family members, consumers, and other constituents statewide to assure that there's maximum representation. There is no general fund required. There is no obligation at the conclusion of the grant to fund ongoing costs, because there are no ongoing costs. The intent of the state, of the division, is to use these funds to pay for materials and the cost of travel and meeting costs to assure that these folks have full participation in this process. The due date is May 2nd. We intend to have that grant on the street then, with your permission. And for that reason, we bring it forward in this at this particular time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Dave Fazier from DAS, Budget and Management Division. We concur with everything Mr. Cast has said and recommend approval of the request.
The Legislative Fiscal Office also recommends approval of the request. We see this as helping to facilitate consumer involvement in a process that the division would have to go through anyway.
Question.
Representative Schrader.
Just a quick question. Is my understanding that the governor has some money in his governor's revised, original budget, too, for implementing some of the parts of Olmstead. Is that correct?
I can take care of that. Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, there are potential Olmstead issues with respect to children and adolescents who stay in psychiatric hospital and psychiatric residential settings, which are the equivalent of hospital-level care. The governor has included in his budget funds for improving the system of care, reducing the length of stay, and making that system more efficient and responsive when kids are ready for placement. From our perspective, we don't believe we have an Olmstead problem, but we want to be sure that in the future that those issues don't face them. And so continuing to improve that system of care is the strategy there. There is nothing targeted for adults in the governor's budget.
I appreciate that's good information. I just would like to get on the record that I appreciate that type of response, that our goal would be with this particular money and this group that you're convening is not to find, hopefully, new and expensive ways to broaden, because we already have a very thin suit. That's the concern. I want to make sure the state of Oregon provides good quality community care. So hopefully that will be a charge that you will take to the group and indicate that it's not all about unlimited funds, and that we want to do the best job possible, make sure that with limited resources, and if there are additional needs, certainly I think legislature will entertain that, but have that as a backdrop upon which this whole discussion takes place.
Madam Chair, I have the same line of concerns. I really hate to see we keep planning and planning and really no funds for implementation. we have to cut existing program that we need to have, and then you plan for more programs. I think the planning money really should be better used for implementation of some direct service.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, since 1988, when the commission appointed by Governor Goldschmidt recommended changes in how we operate our state hospital services, we have effectively had a plan for continuing our effort to serve people in community rather than institutional settings. And the funding for that has continually come from changes in the state hospitals and from allocations made by the legislature during the interim, usually in response to crowding pressures. So we do have, increased, as I pointed out in our testimony several weeks ago, hundreds and hundreds of beds in residential, acute inpatient, other settings to reduce our reliance on the state hospital. At present, we're faced with a lawsuit on which I can't comment in detail, but I can say that the Supreme Court has basically set a condition that says, in effect, if the state has an effectively working plan that's continually moving toward that goal, then the state would, in effect, be immune from litigation under this decision. We believe we've had a plan. We have a planning process underway. The federal grant will permit us to include more family members and consumers from throughout the state and other constituents in assuring that that plan has broad support and represents the popular understanding of the people of the state who have an interest in mental health services. So it's really not planning in lieu of doing something. It's really planning and developing support for continuing this effort into the future.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, Madam Chair. I hope the planning will bring input for a more variety of citizens and have better coordination. So when the plan is implemented, it will be a plan that's well coordinated without too much duplication or fragmentation.
Thank you, Senator Yee. Madam Chair, that is our goal.
And I'm want to say I'm appreciative that you presented the request in a timely fashion, and that we're not looking at after the grant application date. And I'm also pleased that you made the point that it's 3 years only, and that there's not the expectation that there is some continuation beyond those 3 years. I had that come home to me last night when we were having the celebration here at the Capitol, and I ran into a person that I have a really lot of respect for when I was in this building and sitting on your side of the table, and it was Deb Potts. And I remembered how it was coming before them to have a request for federal application, and it was always, what's the length, what's the impact, and what's the long-range implications are for Oregon. So I can appreciate that you're telling us that it's 3 times only and that there's not the continuation of looking to us for additional funding. So I want to thank you. Representative Schrader.
I'd like to move we approve the request for submission of a Federal Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration Center for Mental Health Services grant in the amount of $60,000. I'll plan for integrated and appropriate community health mental health services for children and adults.
Representative Schrader, move the approval of the submission of Federal Substance Abuse Mental Health Services grant application. Is there any discussion, further discussion? Any objections? Approved. I'm closing the public hearing work session on the grant application, federal grant application request, and opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 5527, Department of Human Services, Grant Higginson, Director of the Health Division, and again, Dave Fraser from Department of Administrative Services. I will remind the committee that we will probably, because session will start at 10 o'clock again this morning, that we will probably have to have complete the health division tomorrow if we do not get through their detail today.
Good morning, Chair Wenders and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I am the acting administrator for the Oregon Health Division Department of Human Services. And before I get started on the program description, yesterday there was a lot of public testimony from my sitting in the audience hearing, listening to it, in addition to some general statements of support for the health division. There were questions that came up on school-based health centers, WICs, the state technical assistance team program, and then the public health improvement plan, particularly how it related to communicable diseases. And if there were any questions that you wanted us to follow up on or future information to get back to us, that you would like us to get back to you, I'd just like to know that. And hearing none, we'll move into the detailed program descriptions. At the request of the chair, I am going to try to move as quickly through this, and maybe we can even get done by 10 o'clock. As we do this, though, I would like to have the center director for each one of the centers come up and sit beside me in case there are more detailed questions that come up, and this would give you an opportunity to meet some additional staff at the health division as well. So the first center that we're going to talk about today is the Center for Disease Prevention and Epidemiology, and the center director is Dr. Mel Cohn. And CDPE identifies, monitors, and controls factors that threaten the health of Oregonian. It is there to detect and investigate disease outbreaks, hazardous exposures, and other threats to health. The center is broken down into 7 program areas: acute and communicable disease prevention, injury prevention and epidemiology, environmental and occupational epidemiology, the HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, and tuberculosis program, health statistics and vital records, health promotion and chronic disease prevention, and then program design and evaluation services, which actually is a joint program with Multnomah County Health Department. For each of the detailed program descriptions, we are not going to talk about all the programs. We've already gone over the multitude of programs that are in the health division, and so instead we're simply going to try to focus on a couple of primary areas that we thought would be of interest. And the first one that we're going to talk about in the program area of health promotion and chronic disease prevention is the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program. This is a program that became available through ballot measures $44 in 1997. Tobacco, as I think you all know, is a major killer, continues to be a major killer both across the nation and in Oregon. Since that program has been implemented, we think that we have seen a number of true successes. Since the program implementation, there are now 75,000 fewer Oregonians smoking, there are 22,000 fewer adolescents smoking, and there are has been a substantial reduction in the percentage of women smoking during pregnancy as well. We think that
there's somewhere in this that we have those kinds of
Yes, there is, and there is some detail in the presentation itself. Also in the sleeve, you should have a copy of the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program report that goes into more detail.
And is the method of collecting the data based on the amount of cigarettes that are sold in Oregon compared to previous times, and does that factor in the black market as well?
Chair Winters, my understanding that it does, and Mel, if you have an additional comment on that.
Yes, Chair Winters. We have attempted to gather the best data that we can on the extent of internet sales and smuggling and so forth on the decrease in consumption of cigarettes. And the data suggest that at most the contribution to this, to the decrease in consumption, is approximately 3%. When we've seen a decrease of over 20%, we think that much of this is due to our program and, of course, other factors that are operating as well. So the smuggling of cigarettes and internet sales is a problem and is an issue, but we don't believe that that accounts for all or even most of the drop in consumption that we've seen.
And Chair Winters, if I could add, I think there is some disagreement on the scope of this problem between us and revenue, and we would be happy to come with revenue and discuss the differences of opinion there. But another thing that I would add is that actually, you know, we're held accountable for the benchmarks, and decrease the consumption is not a benchmark. There are three benchmarks, which I've already dealt with. That is the number of adolescents that are smoking, the number of adults who are smoking, and the number of pregnant women who are smoking. And for each one of those benchmarks, we have seen substantial improvements since the implementation of the program.
Senator Shields.
Yes, this is a follow-up to the chair's question. When she asked about black market, is there any indication that black market would have increased after about Measure 44? Or at least are we comparing apples to apples in that probably the same percentage operated before as afterwards, so that the decrease is probably pretty reliable? And the second part of the question would be 22,000 less adolescents. That's in a population that's increasing, so that it's an actual drop of 22,000, or is it 22,000 less than, you know, than it would have been given the population increase?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, yes, I think that with regard to your first question, the data on it's very difficult to track how big a problem and to measure how big a problem the smuggling and internet sales is. The best data that we have available, we think, comes from our behavioral risk factor surveillance survey, where we ask people whether they bought cigarettes over the internet and so forth. We have those data over a number of years. I'm afraid I don't have a comparison of them pre-Measure 44, so it may well be that that problem increased. And in fact, with the increase in price of cigarettes, one would expect that the incentive to do smuggling and so forth would drive that process somewhat. So I do think this is a problem that merits some attention, and it deprives all of us in the state of the revenue that would have been generated from taxing those cigarettes. So I don't mean in any way to minimize or say that that isn't a problem that should be dealt with. But I can't quantify the number in the way that you've asked. We just don't have those data available.
Isn't that quite a contradiction? You talked about the revenue piece of it, and yet, I mean, I think the same issue that we have with the alcohol issue. On the one hand, we're looking for the revenue that these products generate. And on the other hand, we're saying that we want people to diminish its intake and its use. I mean, to me, that's very conflicting policy or conflicting position.
Madam Chair, I agree with you. There is some contradiction in that, and I would be very happy if we were so successful in our tobacco use efforts that we essentially eliminated that source of funding for the program. Unfortunately, we're quite a long ways from being in that situation. But it is a contradiction inherent in the way it's financed.
Correct. I guess I don't hear anybody talking about a reduction in revenue. I hear everybody talking about an increase in revenue. Representative Bates.
I would like to point out that you've got to look at a little bigger picture on this thing. As smoking goes down, ultimately our health costs drop dramatically. And it's probably a factor of 4 or 5 to 1. So, I mean, every time you get somebody to quit smoking, you save a huge amount of money on the other side as far as cutting down on health factors. Now, some of those things you won't see for 10 or 15 years, but some of it you'll see right up front with a decrease in bronchitis and pneumonia, which is an immediate effect of quitting smoking. So you've got to look at the whole picture of the whole budget before you start saying that it's a contradictory situation. The question I'd really like to ask is, where do you actually get your data on smoking? I mean, we're kind of bouncing around here. I wonder if you do a scientific study, population-based, you know, randomized, and is it something that really tells you how many people are smoking, not smoking, and how big the sample size is?
Chair Winters, Representative Bates, one thing that I just passed out was from the most recent benchmarks report from the Progress Board, and I apologize for the cut and paste, but that's the only way I could get the three benchmarks onto that page. Benchmark number 53, see the cigarettes smoked in the previous month by eighth graders. You'll see that has actually gone down. And this is percentage, not numbers now, Senator Shields, that we're talking about. 1996, before the program began, 22%. And the year 2013 percent. Those data are collected from the Youth Behavior Risk Survey, which is done every other year across the state and schools. Last time it was done, I believe over 40,000 students participated in that survey. Benchmark number 56, the percentage of women, pregnant women who abstains for smoking tobacco, that is one we expect to go to increase if we're doing the job correctly. And in 1996, you'll see that was 82% before the program began. In 1999, which is the last year we have data for, is 86%. That data is from birth certificate information. And then the final of the three benchmarks is benchmark number 44, which is the percentage of Oregonians 18 and older who smoke cigarettes, and that has gone from 23% prior to the program to 21%. And even though that is a small decrease, that is a substantial decrease because it's such a large population, and that's where we get the 75,000. That information is collected from the Behavioral Risk Factor Survey, which is an ongoing survey that we do that I believe targets about 5,000 people each year. There has been some recent work done that has shown that self-report of tobacco smoking actually is a good and accurate measure for whether or not people are smoking and the amount of cigarettes that they are smoking. Moving on from tobacco, the other program we're going to talk about in disease prevention and epidemiology is the Emerging Infections Program. And I think that one of the true public health and medical successes over this past century has been the work that we have done to eliminate or at least reduce the damage done by infectious diseases. However, we are not done. And in fact, even after adjusting for the AIDS epidemic, we are now finding that infectious diseases, death from infectious diseases, have actually increased over recent years. And there are a number of new and emergent diseases like toxic shock syndrome, AIDS, Lyme disease, E. coli 0157, which all of you heard about in Marion County not too long ago, and the hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, which are continuing to emerge in Oregon as well as across the nation as real problems. We also know that as well as emerging new infections, that viruses and bacteria continue to mutate. We have new strains of meningococcus that were introduced in the Pacific Northwest about 10 years ago and are causing a number of problems. Again, a recent outbreak in Marion County is good evidence of that. We are also finding that there are a number of bacteria that are becoming more resistant to antibiotics, sometimes because of the inappropriate use of antibiotic treatment. We are one of a very few number of states that have been granted from the Centers for Disease Control a emerging infections program. We are very happy to have those dollars because we are going to use those to explore new areas of epidemiology around a number of invasive bacterial pathogens like meningococcus, Haemophilus influenza, etc. Use those dollars to, again, to detect and control foodborne illnesses, to expand our capacity to detect the occurrence of new emergent diseases like the West Nile virus that we heard about a couple of years ago in New York City and are hoping to keep from the borders of Oregon. And so with that, I'll close on that program unless there's particular questions people have on emerging infection.
Senator Yee, I have a question. So in number 52, percentage of pregnant women who abstain from using alcohol, I'm comparing 96 to 99, it's the same. And tobacco use, the people who abstain have increased to 86, so you have a success rate of 4%. But why no improvement in alcohol use?
Chairwinder, Senator Yee, a couple of things. First is that if you'll notice, it says that women are really almost 100% not using alcohol currently during pregnancy. That would be one reason that we're not seeing much in the way of increase. However, as I was explaining earlier about tobacco actually being good source of data in self-report, we also know that in the case of alcohol, alcohol self-reporting is not a good indicator. That is not particularly good data, and I am certain that there are more than 2% of women who are pregnant who are actually using alcohol.
Grant, just follow along, because fetal alcohol syndrome and drug syndrome is one of your major concerns and issues, and I know you don't have drugs on here, and if alcohol is almost at 100%, then why are we still discussing the issue of fetal alcohol, or why is there still a problem?
And Chair Winters, that's what I was trying to say is that alcohol reports on the birth certificate are not a particularly good measure. Unfortunately, that is the only data source that we have now for alcohol. Drugs also are not particularly well measured using birth certificate data. And actually, I apologize for the cut and paste. There should be a 52C down there that does have other drugs as well. It just got cut off.
Because
what I was trying to focus on here was tobacco.
Senator Duncan.
I'm curious. You said on the birth certificate, what does it say on the birth certificate? Is there a check for...
Chairwinder, Senator Duncan, yes, there is there's two parts of the birth certificate. The top part is the actual certificate piece, which has the name, the father's and mother's name, the physician's name, the hospital of birth, residence, all of those kind of things. There's also then under that a medical portion that is actually a confidential portion of the birth certificate that's treated as a medical record. And on that part of the birth certificate, there are a number of questions, including occupation, prenatal history, complications during pregnancy, and there is one box where we're talking about other issues, which has whether or not they smoked during pregnancy, whether or not they used alcohol, whether or not other drugs were used.
I can see why your data would not be very scientific, because as a mother, those are invasive questions, and particularly if you're going to put it on the birth certificate.
And Chair Winters, as I was trying to explain, there's some information that is very good. APGAR, birth weight, those pieces of information are very reliable. There's also been work done that has shown that tobacco use during pregnancy is a reliable source from birth certificate data. There's other information like alcohol and drugs that is not good. There's other information like birth defects that, even though it should be good because they're oftentimes not picked up at the time of birth, that's not good data either. So some of it is very good and reliable, and some of it is questionable. On the self-reporting data, though, we do have, like I said, recent evidence that shows that is reliable information.
Representative Bateman, Senator Yee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a sticky problem, of course, because patients don't want to admit to these problems.
Right.
We've used screening programs in various counties, and at one point we're screening 100% for several years. Where is the state as far as screening pregnancy? And it's pretty easy to do. You collect urine every time you see a patient. What's happening as far as a screening program to really see what the size of the problem is?
Chairman, Representative Bates, are you referring to illegal drugs in particular, or tobacco and alcohol as well?
Tobacco, alcohol, and illegal drugs, all three.
Right. And Chairman, Representative Bates, for alcohol and tobacco, I don't think a lot is being done right now. For one thing, they're both legal substances. It is very difficult to screen for alcohol because of the metabolism.
Right.
It oftentimes don't get it. There has been a push, and actually more, 5 to 10 years ago than there has been over the last 5 years, to do more in the way of testing all pregnant women for illegal substances. That ran into a lot of civil liberty challenges. It's still something that we clearly work with the OB community to make sure that people are screening women for all substance use, alcohol, tobacco, and illegal drugs during history. But right now, I don't think that a whole lot is being done in the way of actual, you know, laboratory testing.
Senator Yee?
No.
And then Senator Duncan, and then Senator Schiff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you use data when you take care of them in the prenatal program so that you can assess them for the use? I mean, do you use those data including in your survey instead of depending on birth certificate information?
Chair Winter, Senator Yee, we do not provide very much in the way of direct prenatal care. And as we've talked about already, you know, that is an issue where local health departments used to provide much more than they do now. Now, very little prenatal care is provided in local health departments. It's all being done by private physicians, nurse midwives, and there has been, and this is something that we worked with the OB community on, the development of a risk factor screening tool that I believe is being used pretty universally now by private physicians as they provide prenatal care. However, there is no system in place right now to collect those data, so that data is not something that we have available to take a look at.
Well, Madam Chair, since this is a pretty critical issue, is there a way for you to collect those data, send a survey out to say, we need those information, and please send us those percentage of use data.
Chair Winters and Senator Yee, there certainly would be ways to do that. There would be ways for us to send out surveys to private physicians. There would be ways for us to require private physicians to report that information. Those things cost money, and a lot of times private physicians are not particularly happy to have additional responsibilities put on them. The other thing that we are doing, and we can talk about this later when the Nelda Dotson's up here with the Center for Child and Family Health, we do have a survey program where we're following up with women about 6 months following their delivery to collect information on the experience they had during prenatal care. But those are the things that we're doing right now, and there are complications, particularly in regards to cost in trying to get additional information.
Are you okay? I just want to know if you can work with the managed care organization where they probably have to provide data to the state or to Oregon Health Plan anyway. Maybe you can work with them also.
Right, Chair Winters, Senator Yee, we actually do work with OMAP and have some joint projects going on where we are looking at data. The OMAP, however, does not have as much encounter data as they used to have, and I would be surprised, I mean, no may know, but I would be surprised if they had that level of detail available easily on the medical management information system that they currently use.
You need to ask them because they are setting up new system. They're talking about replacement system. So this is one of the data you could ask for.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question. I recognize how difficult gathering information is and yet how useful it is, but at the same time you have the whole civil liberties question, the invasion of privacy question. In addition to that, is there any evidence that if you try to gather too much data, you actually end up with people, and maybe the doctor over here knows better, do you have people that just skip prenatal care if they begin to fear that somebody might discover illegal drugs? Do you have any evidence of that kind of thing?
Chairwinter, Senator Shields, as I mentioned, there was really a push for screening for illegal drugs 5 to 10 years ago, and one of the reasons why people did not adopt universal screening across the country or in the state was exactly for that concern. The concern was that this was something that very well might have driven a lot of women underground and not to receive the care. I can't say off the top of my head whether I know that there is definitive research that shows that, but that clearly was a fear and one of the reasons why that wasn't adopted.
Grant, we are interested in this whole subject and this issue, and I want to go back a little bit. Could you provide me with the programs and the utilization of the Measure 44 funds that are directly related to prevention and that are non-related to or the activity of lobbying and those kinds of activities? There's some real concern that a percentage of the dollars that are used for education and prevention are actually being used for other than that activity. And also how those dollars flow down to the local communities.
Madam Chair.
Reverend Bates.
Going back to the previous question just for a moment, there's another way around this too. We routinely screen all newborns for illicit drugs. That should give you some idea of the percentage of women using illicit drugs too. Do you have that data available? I know you're doing two things at once.
Chair Winters, Representative Bate, I'm not sure what you're talking about when you say we screen them all for illegal drugs.
First babies and sometimes more than that are screened for illicit drugs. There's not a civil liberties problem here as far as I know. It gets good health care. So we screen all those babies. If the baby comes up positive, obviously the baby didn't go out in the street and get, methamphetamine, the mother took it. And we do it right after delivery. And that information can be backed up to say, and give us some idea of what's going on with those women, too, as far as taking illicit drugs. Do you have that kind of data available for us?
Chair Winters, Representative Bates, that is not something that is reported to us. So, no, we do not have that data.
Is Babies First is one of your programs, is it not?
Chair Winters, yes, it is. Actually, I was looking for Katie King because, Katie, do you have copies of the information that we're providing for testimony this afternoon? One thing that we did for testimony for a bill that is being heard this afternoon is come up with a breakdown of by dollars and percentage amount how all of the tobacco prevention and education funds are being utilized. And if we have copies of that now, I can get that to you right now. Otherwise, we can get that to you later. And the whole issue of lobbying and inappropriate use of tobacco education and prevention has been something that has been batted around in a number of committees and a number of different bills this session. I firmly believe that the vast majority of the dollars that are being used for that program are being used very appropriately, and I think that the fact that we are able to show some real successes in reductions in tobacco use by both adolescents and adults is something that we are actually proud of.
It's an issue I want to follow.
And we're certainly more than willing to talk to you about that, Chair. Moving on to the essential packages, on page 58, those are issues that Mr. Fraser has already gone through, unless there was further discussion on those. One of the issues that I did want to talk about was on page 60 when we're talking about budget reductions. The governor's recommended budget reduction for the disease prevention epidemiology unit does include the elimination of the state technical assistance team. This is something that you heard about yesterday in the public testimony. That if we eliminate STAT, well, with the elimination of the STAT program, we will lose the capacity to collect data on child fatalities across the state, and we'll lose the coordination and oversight that the STAT team has provided to local child fatality review teams, which are mandated in 35 of the counties. In the way of enhancement packages, starting on page 62, I believe that both of these on page 62 and 63 are really pretty much technical adjustments, as well as policy package 118 on page 64. Policy package 119, also on page 64, is an actual significant increase in funds for the tobacco program that was included in the governor's recommended budget of $7 million.
people may or may not know that the current funding level for our tobacco program is actually quite a bit less than what the Centers for Disease Control recommends for that kind of program. Also, with the decreased revenues, there's going to be a loss of funding. That $7 million would...
Representative Schrader.
That $7 million would be used to keep the program at the current level and then also to expand activities.
I guess I have two questions. And on the other smaller technical packages, there's some new positions in package 117, some limited duration that become permanent positions. I wanted to know whether or not it was anticipated at the time these grants were let that we would have ongoing programs, or are the new permanent positions a result of the studies that were done by the grants and resulted in the new positions.
And Chair Winters, Representative Schrader, my understanding, and Malcolm, correct me if this is wrong, is that this is actually extending current grants into the following biennium. This is not asking to use general fund to continue activities that were started in the grant, and my anticipation is that those programs, that funding will go away at the time of the end of the grant.
Obvious question would be that I'm not sure they would have to be permanent positions, but we can look at that, I guess, a little bit later. That's good. You also mentioned on the $7 million tobacco enhancement that kind of allowed you to do what you're doing now, and I guess I thought as an enhancement it was in addition to the CSL, the roll-up of what we already do put in for tobacco prevention. And to follow up, I appreciate the good data you gave us on the progress board. It would be interesting to see the dollar amounts, as we've talked about, that flow to the tobacco prevention program over the last few years, and the people, the FTE that are associated with that, and then we can superimpose that, I suppose, on the results you've already given us.
Right. Chair Winters, Representative Schrader, the $7 million would primarily be used for expansions to the program or enhancements to the existing projects that we are doing. What I was trying to say was that there is a small amount due to reduced revenues that this would also be used for as well.
Madam Chair?
Senator Shields.
I was somewhat alarmed that you said that we're quite a bit below what the Center for Disease Control recommends. Can you expand on that? And are we behind other states as well? I mean,
Chair Winters, Senator Shields, the Centers for Disease Control has come up with a set of materials that they are saying are best practices, the kind of things that states should be doing in order to have an effective tobacco program. And we are using those best practices in the development of our program as well. For each one of those best practices, they have an estimated amount of dollars that should go to that. And when you look at those dollars, we are below what the Centers for Disease Control recommends. When you look at other states, however, my guess is, and Mel may want to comment on this, my guess is that we're actually doing better than a lot of states, because we do have the tobacco tax funds that are specifically directed to prevention and education, which a lot of states do not.
So I think you can't look at this figure without looking at the other activity that's going on in Oregon and in other areas that states may or may not be doing. So sometimes we can't compare ourselves with other states.
Madam Chair? For the record, Dave Fazer from DAS Budget Management. I wanted to address Representative Schrader's comment regarding permanent versus limited duration positions, particularly as they relate to a federal effort. It's generally our policy that we approve limited duration positions, and then where we find that funding is pretty much confirmed to be continuing funding for the benefit of the program over multi-biennia, for the benefit of the program and the recruiting of quality people into those positions, if the agency sees they have an advantage in converting that to a permanent position for a multi-biennial use, they are in a much better position to hire a quality person in the position and keep that person in that position for continuity purposes rather than having a position expire at the end of each budget session. And that would be the reason that we would consider and recommend approval of a permanent position in regards to a federal fund.
Registrator.
But if they already have the job, I mean, we've already got that individual, unless you're going to hire a new individual, is that the Two comments. One is, I'm not sure I follow your reasoning, since we're already have that person in the limited duration position, so we're not really attracting a new individual.
Mm-hmm.
And then number two, multi-banding, I could see that if it's, you know, one of these, some of these grants go on kind of ad infinitum, there's others that are 3 years, and that would not be multi-banding, if you will, in my opinion.
That's correct. Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, the issue is that if a person who is already in a position now was hired for 2 years, if this was approved as a limited duration position for another 2 years, vice a permanent position for the expected, say, 6 years of the funding of the grant, that person is motivated to look for other opportunities that guarantee more security.
Since we're talking about FTEs, what's your vacancy factor?
Do you have that?
Chair Winters, we believe it's about 15% of the presence. That we will get that number to you.
Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Madam Chair, I have to leave to go to Governor's Conference on Livability in Corvallis, and I just want to point out an enhancement program package on page 118, if I may. It deals with money for Office of Multicultural Health. And in Lane County, there's a real increase in Hispanic population. And they don't usually go to alcohol and drug treatment programs, but their culture will bring them to the mother and child care clinic. So in that case, you can kind of screen out for mothers who need prevention and intervention. So I would appreciate the committee's consideration in allocating some money to counties with a real increase in the minority population to help them address some priority youth.
The enhancement package here is a combination of mostly it's data collecting and some of those that are in here that was done as a result of the interim committee study, which Senator Gordley and I was somewhat involved with. And Senator Gordley is meeting with others and trying to get this pieces of this through. Questions that were raised in some of this was, isn't there the ability currently within the department to be able to do some of this without us going into having to add new resources? And that discussion is being held with them.
Oh, using the department's existing resources.
Yes.
I see. But anyway, in Lane County's public health manager's testimony, she indicated that they cannot meet bilingual, bicultural needs of the growing population. So I just appreciate the opportunity to point it out, and if there's any enhancement, maybe there's some areas we can help.
Thank you. Have a good trip.
Thank you.
Drive safe.
I'll try.
You may continue.
Chair Winters, you have now received the breakdown that I was talking about with the dollar figures and the percentage of funds that go to the different components of the tobacco prevention and education program. The biggest chunk, individual chunk of funding, 36% of all of the dollars go to local coalitions. Those local coalitions then decide what are the community values and norms in their community and what are those issues that they want to work towards. One of those issues, one of those best practices, and again this comes directly from the Centers for Disease Control, is working towards the passage of local ordinances. That is something that they can choose to do, that is not something that they have to choose to do. That, however, that one piece of the local coalition's work is the thing that has gotten a lot of interest. And
it's gotten so much interest that this body is being put in the position of overriding local preemptions. And that's what's stirring up the debate and the discussions. And it's also stirring up the discussion, you know, having to do with the some other issues. And so when I say that money is used for lobby, I can remember in the old days, I think it was under the Hatch Act, you couldn't do stuff like this. But
And Chair Winters, money cannot be used for lobbying. And we have gotten some, and we'll pull a packet together for you if you desire information that we've already provided to Smart Growth and Commerce Committee. Money cannot be used for lobbying. That guidance that we have provided to local communities is specifically states that once a measure gets to the ballot, then no one that is receiving public dollars can use those dollars to influence the ballot. There is a lot, though, that can be done in working towards local ordinances prior and up to that. Including doing an assessment to see whether or not the community supports that kind of work, providing information on best practices to local policymakers, and we have had our Attorney General take a look at that and has said that there are no state laws that prohibit that there may be local laws that prohibit providing that kind of information, sharing that kind of information, and that is the guidance that we have provided to counties.
Madam Chairman,
Senator,
could you explain the preemption?
Well, what's occurring, it's similar to what has occurred in Corvallis and some of the other cities, and I'm going to declare a conflict of interest, although I don't smoke in my restaurant and I don't have smoking in my restaurant. What is occurring, though, however, is through these funds, which is actually coming from the entities, they're getting the local ordinances, and so you have that's coming to this level that's saying that, there's a bill right now that's in to preempt your local cities from doing just this. Mm-hmm. And here we also on this committee and others are providing funds that are doing the same thing. And I know you say that there isn't lobbying, but I think maybe you need a definition of lobbying because, in fact, individuals have visited individuals and working on behalf of this, and that is lobbying. And so, it's an issue, and I know you're going to address it in some of the other committees. I think there's two or three committees that's looking at this particular issue now and whether or not this is really inappropriate. And I just raised that because it came up to me yesterday.
And Chair Winters, besides the preemption bill in Smart Growth and Commerce, there is another bill, 2874, that deals with a provision of not being able to use these dollars for lobbying
this
activities.
This is my line, yeah.
Right, this was then changed to advocacy. That passed out of committee.
I'm going to make you a senator.
This is a hot issue, and we spent 4 hours or 5 hours in hearing and discussing on it in the Smart Growth and Commerce, and there is a fine line here, and it may have been breached in a few places, but the vast majority of testimony led us to believe that it wasn't, and that's going to be a point of discussion not only on the bill on the floor today, which is a preemption bill which says basically that local ordinances can't be passed above a certain level the state's going to set, which I'm opposed to, but that's a conflict also. But in the discussion we went through was what is lobbying, and when do you cross over from lobbying into giving information? And requesting information, giving information is one thing. The step across the line to advocate for a certain ordinance or put money into to try to put an ordinance on the ballot or to get that ordinance passed on the ballot is clearly inappropriate. And we weren't able to find that actually had occurred. It may have occurred in some instances we're not aware of, but we couldn't actually find that in the committee. So to say to Department of Health, you can't say anything negative about cigarette smoking when people are discussing this local level is inappropriate, but it's also inappropriate to cross the line, and it is a tough one to call.
And Chair Winters, Representative Bates, just to follow up on that, one of the concerns that I have is that so much attention is being focused on this one issue. That although it is controversial and a difficult issue, that is just a real small piece of what we're doing in the tobacco education and prevention program. I mean, that's just one of the things that local coalitions do. They do many other things in trying to restrict use, restrict access to tobacco products by youth and working with schools and trying to adopt voluntary policies in the workplace. There's lots of other things that coalitions are doing. And in addition to that, 11% of the dollars goes directly to schools for smoke-free school programs. 6% goes to multicultural and tribal programs. There are 14% goes to an Oregon quit line that is actually contracted out through Kaiser, and we think that we're showing some good success there. 16% goes to a media campaign, which again we believe has been very successful. So there may be some controversy around one particular part of the program. We think that the comprehensiveness of the program has made it a very effective program.
Representative Schrader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would be interesting to know which of these nine components has been the most successful. I'd like that information. That way, if we do some targeted funding, that would help us help you do a good job.
Chair Winters, Representative Schrader, it's a very difficult question to answer, and in fact, although a very important question to try to answer, we think actually that what makes our program successful is its comprehensiveness and the fact that it isn't just one of these modalities, but in fact many of them. And for example, there have been some data from Washington State showing that some of the school-based efforts, when done in a vacuum, without all of the other reinforcing messages coming through, have not been successful, whereas we actually have some new data on our school-based program suggesting that they have been quite successful when they're done in the context of the media and public education work that we do and all the other pieces of the program that Grant has already enumerated for you. So that's been not only our experience here in terms of the recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control as well. The comprehensiveness of the program is, I think, a very key factor in its success.
Follow up.
I appreciate that, and I'm sure you are correct. I would hope that over time, you would try and fall on which of the components. Not that we're going to do just one. I think you make a strong case that we'll do several, but any person that advertises or does any outreach of any sort, some things are more successful than others, and you would want to continue to fund those variety of programs that are most successful. So I think future legislatures would like to have that information so we can help you.
Chairman, as Representative Schrader, if you turn on the back page, you'll see that there's 5% of the funds do go to evaluation, and that is actually conducted by a group not in the tobacco program, but the program design and evaluation group that is doing that work. That work is guided by an advisory committee that includes statewide and national experts on tobacco reduction and on research, and we will definitely get that request back to that advisory group in working on future evaluation over the biennium.
Just like to
follow up.
Just last comment. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but I'd like to see what works in Oregon. There are a lot of studies done. I see, particularly with alcohol, lots of studies done, but I want to see something that actually works in the state of Oregon. So I'm agreeing with you.
I would like to see what works in Oregon. I would also like to see that your target age group. One of the issues around smoking was the prevention of young people to so that they don't smoke, and I noted in looking at your program at your school-based program is 11%, your advertising is 30%, and when we look at success, I would like to know from an age category where we're having the successes. Are we having it with the young people? Are we having it with those of us who are chronologically advantaged and have become frightened because of some medical diagnosis that have occurred and so we quit? What really are the ages that we're talking about? Is it the moms with that are pregnant and then they quit and they continue the cessation? So for me, I'd like to know the universe, because that means if we're targeting our dollars, then we're targeting them wisely if it's the youth population that really we're seeing the successes. So for me, that would be very helpful information.
And Chair Winters, that is where we are seeing the most success.
With children, with the young.
Right. And if you look at the benchmarks, you'll see that there is a much more dramatic decrease since the program began in the youth population than in the adult population. And actually, that decrease is about double the national average decrease for adolescents when you see tobacco taxes increase. So we think that's a very positive thing. But just to follow up on something that Dr. Cohn mentioned, is that we believe it is because we're not just focusing on school-based programs or programs that are just targeted to adolescents. In order for it really to work for adolescents, you need to have it be seen as a community norm of something that we're working towards. And the fact that school-based programs have not worked so well in Washington, I think, again, is a reason why we think the comprehensive approach is necessary.
Well, I've seen some of the ads on TV, and I would And if I was a kid, I don't think I would be that excited about them. But I guess I'm not a kid anymore. I'm a chronologically advantaged individual.
Excited about smoking or?
Well, no, you know.
The impact.
You know, the impact. Because, you know, there's a different message that children, that young adults connect to than what those of us were. Then we connect to. It's all a part of their cultural climate than our cultural climate. And I can recall when my children, my sons were coming along, particularly those young people who were athletic inclined, they got the message very quickly that smoking was a no-no, and, you know, through their coaches and through their environment in the schools, and they would come home and say, why don't you join the in crowd? You know, that was the language then. Well, of course, I think the kids have a different language today than that language. And I'm just saying that if you target young people in their environment and what they see on that great big screen, it's different than what you and I pick up as a message.
And Chair, I just noticed lately, and maybe I'm wrong, I think when I was younger, every movie you went to, everybody was smoking. The women, everybody was smoking. You saw in the theater. Then it got to the point where you just don't see smoking in movies. But all of a sudden, I'm starting to see some smoking again in movies. And
the martini's back.
Pardon?
The martini's back. The martini was gone by the wayside. Yeah. And I understand that the East Coast is bringing the martini back. Dr. Bates.
Yeah, the question that I always ask in these things is, just because we do a program and we see a decrease in smoking or an increase in smoking, how do we know that program works? The only way I know that to do that is you go back to the people who quit smoking and ask them, what influenced you to quit smoking? And what I like to know is, on these various programs you've done here, have you ever gone back and asked a significant part of the population what caused you to decrease smoking? When I ask my patients that question, I hate to tell you, but I never hear much about these programs. It's peer pressure from family, from their physician. They saw somebody die from smoking, and that's what does it. And I also think that for a lot of them, they've told me that local ordinances that prevent them from smoking in public, well, gee, I couldn't smoke at work anymore, I couldn't smoke in the hospital anymore, I couldn't smoke, I just decided maybe I'll go ahead and quit. And I was surprised when my patients have told me that too. So my question is, have you gone back on these individual programs and asked people who quit smoking, did these influence you?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we do some follow-up work. We're beginning to do more of that now. I don't have the exact answer to your question, but I think that the way you described how your patients talk about why they quit kind of speaks to this issue of comprehensiveness that I was talking about before, that it's hearing all of these messages from a variety of sources, even in subtle ways. I mean, what creates that peer pressure? Part of that, we hope, is our media campaign and so forth. So that's one issue. And the other thing is that whenever you look to try to determine the effect of the program, what you want to do is find some comparison. So when we compare ourselves, for example, to what's going on nationally, we know that our rates are dropping at a much faster rate. Our rates of cigarette use are dropping at a much faster rate. So we're doing something different. Something different is happening in Oregon, and we try to, as objectively as possible, look at all of the different factors that could be contributing. And for that reason, we believe it's not all the tobacco program's doing, but we do think that it is having a positive impact.
And Chair Winters, I just wanted to follow up on your issue about youth and the media campaigns. In order to cut costs, we, instead of developing our own public service announcements, we are utilizing ones that are already available to the greatest extent possible. All of those that we use or think we might use are tested in focus groups using adolescents, and we use ones that appeal to the younger population.
Madam Chair, if I may add, too, that it's been quite interesting in those focus groups that the Oregon youth seem to be a little different from youth in other states, so that's been extremely useful for us, and things that we thought were going to work beautifully, we've thrown out because they haven't panned out.
Well, Oregon is unique. I had to add that because we are unique out here. So I can see where we would not necessarily follow the trends. And if you look at really trends, whether you're talking clothing or smoking or whatever, the East Coast tends to be the leader, with the exception of one issue, and that is the methamphetamine issue, which started from the, everybody knows my pitch, my coming. It started from out here and making its way east, and we cannot be proud of that. But other than that, we tend to wait until things evolve to us. But since we're talking about demographics, it would be helpful for me, as you break down the age categories, to also break down the ethnic categories, because I suspect in the issue that we're talking about, that your consumption is probably greater among that population group if I look at it from a demographic standpoint. And so then if we're targeting, if we're actually targeting to try to get at solutions, I think that our dollars should follow where you've got the greatest need. I'd follow the governor's logic that where the need is the greatest, that's where we need to target the resources. So if you can come back and tell me what your demographics tell you with respect to our population.
And Chair Winters, we will try to do that. You know, as you know, one of the issues that was raised by the Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force over the interim was the fact that we do not have a lot of good data around a number of issues for minority populations. But it is an issue that we do think, totally agree with you, it is important, and you'll see that a 6% of the dollars over and above everything else that's being done in the general population is specifically targeted to multicultural and tribal programs.
Those most mainly tribal programs?
A number of them are tribal programs. There are some other programs. The African American Health Coalition, I know, is getting some tobacco dollars. And I'm not sure who else. No.
Just give me the demographics.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
And then, unless there are further questions, that finishes the discussion, detailed program description on the Chronic Disease and Prevention Center. Do we have time to start moving into the Center for Public Health Laboratories? Yes?
Okay.
And if, as Mel leaves, I'd ask Dr. Mike Skeels to come to the table. And the Center for Public Health Laboratories provides testing for both human and non-human specimens needed to support our public health mission. The lab is comprised of four programs. The first is virology immunology, that basically is dealing with viruses, and the second is general microbiology, dealing with bacteria, and it's those two programs really that are providing the backbone of communicable disease support for local health departments, as well as providing some of those services on a statewide basis, such as testing for rabies. Another large program, one I've mentioned briefly before, is the newborn screen program, which screens all newborns for a number of metabolic and other disorders at the time of birth, and also acts as a regional laboratory, and then the laboratory licensing program. The newborn screening program, Oregon should be proud, again, showing its uniqueness in that in 1964, Oregon became the first state in the country to do universal screening for newborns who had phenylketonuria or PKU. Prior to that time, about 1% of the population in Fairview and in other mental institutions across the country were there because of mental retardation caused by PKU. Since the start of this program, there has never been another child admitted to the Oregon system for PKU disorder. We also provide not only testing for all of Oregon's children, but also for the regional program that provides services for Alaska, Hawaii, Idaho, and Nevada as well. We screen a total of over 100,000, 130,000 infants per year. We currently screen for a number of metabolic disorders that you can read about, and that is something that in the future, and we'll talk about this later, are hoping to expand.
I understand we have a minimal charge to the other states. Is that true?
Chair Winters, that is true. And actually, Mike Skeels can probably tell you how much over the cost is.
Chairman Winters, I'm Mike Skeels, Director of the Public Health Laboratory, for the record. We have a standard package that we charge for a panel of five tests for the other states, and then if they want to add on other tests like sickle cell disease or others that aren't in the standard five, then we charge a little more for each of those to recover our costs. The standard package is $9, and then it goes up from there depending on what else they want to add on. But we do recover our costs and a little bit more from them.
Just a tad bit.
Yes, Chair Winters. We want enough that it helps keep our program solvent, but we also don't want to become dependent upon them.
The second issue that I wanted to talk about was communicable disease testing, and this actually does have a direct relationship to the newborn screening program, because in 1991, with the passage of Ballot Measure 5, the legislature directed us to subsidize communicable disease testing by charging an additional $5 for each of the newborn screening specimens that were submitted to us. And actually, over the last 10 years, we've had a decrease in the amount of general fund for the public health laboratory than we had prior to Ballot Measure 5. House Bill 2268, which this committee will be hearing, passed out of Substance Committee, would increase the fees upward so that we could do a few things. One is we need a couple of dollars per specimen to simply improve the existing technology that we have for the existing tests. We need another couple of dollars to add congenital adrenal hyperplasia to the screening panel, and then we need an additional $6 to add a new kind of technology, tandem mass spectrometry, which would allow us to screen for additional 20 disorders, most of which are preventable, some of which are very easily preventable.
See if I'm tracking your math. So you're going from $5 to $16? $5, what? Give me
okay.
The amount.
And
let me to answer that one.
Yeah, why don't you do that, Mike?
Chair Winters, the current statutory cap for newborn screening is $16 per specimen. And what Grant was saying is that of that $16, we take $5 off the top and use it to subsidize communicable disease testing, which has nothing directly to do with newborn metabolic screening. And so we're doing the screening for $11 and recovering our costs. But what's happened through time is that because of inflationary increase and one thing or the other, and because the cap has not been raised for 8 years now, we no longer have enough money available to pay for all the communicable disease testing because we need to use it for newborn metabolic screening. So that's one problem. And then another is that there's been a big change in technology and standard of practice in the country in the last couple of years, and we have a bill which would allow us to raise the fees enough to allow us to expand to cover the new technology. I don't think you probably want to have the hearing right now on House Bill 2268, but we are currently asking the co-chairs for permission to schedule that hearing. And we can provide you with a lot more detail at that time.
Who pays the fees?
The fees are paid up front by hospitals, who then recover those costs from insurance companies.
If I could comment, Madam Chair.
Representative.
This is a program that is incredibly successful, and the amount of money spent on it is minimal for what they find. This is something that the child gets when it's first born and repeated in the doctor's office. To get that form and the way we draw the blood to the doctor's office a week, 10 days later is a bit of a chore. It's done extremely well, extremely well. And these people are extremely easy to work with. They've made this program very, very successful. And I know what the odds are of getting a new PKU child in your practice, but I hit one 5 years ago. I got about 20 phone calls, all telling me, don't forget about Holly, okay? And she has a normal life now because of what happened there. So this is a great program, and one that should be continued and fully funded as necessary. So I look forward to seeing 2668.
Thank you for that very much. One of the strengths of this program is it's not just a lab test. It's an actual integrated program that has follow-up and referral and assistance to physicians like Representative Bates in managing patients, which they might only see once in their entire career. So we're very proud of it. Thank you.
Bates declares a conflict of interest.
I'll declare a good conflict of interest. Okay.
And Chair Winters, if I might add, the substantive committee that heard House Bill 2268, I mean, they were, again, very supportive of the program. They also said that they would like to see the updating and expansion of newborn screening, and the basic issue from them was, what are we going to do about the $5 subsidy? And I mean, that subsidy could continue, new dollars could be found, or simply say that we're no longer going to subsidize those tests. But as you heard yesterday, communicable disease is a major issue for local health departments, and if those tests were not subsidized, I can guarantee you that a number of tests simply would not be done. And then the third issue that we're going to talk about in the Center for Public Health Laboratories is the laboratory licensing program. There are almost 2,000 laboratories in the state of Oregon, either clinical labs, substance abuse screening laboratories, drinking water labs, and then a few health screening testing permit labs. We are responsible for the licensing or certification of all those laboratories. That includes an inspection of about 250 laboratories a year. We also provide consultation and technical assistance and monitor the performance of those laboratories. The licensing program has actually shrunk over the last biennium. We used to have what we thought was a very good total exemption program, where instead of HCFA being involved in this, we had the program in totally for ourselves and for a fee that was less than the fee that HCFA charges. We were able to do more inspections and provide more technical assistance and consultation. However, during the biennium, HCFA decided to triple the cost for us to maintain that exemption program, and consequently we were just financially not able to do that. So we currently maintain our relationship as the licensor by contracting with HCFA to do that, but unfortunately we don't feel it is as strong a program as it used to be. On page 73 we have the essential packages, which again I'm not going to go through as Mr. Fazier already did that, unless you have specific questions. There were no reduction options put forward by the that were included in the governor's recommended budget. One option that was put on the table was $715,000 reduction in communicable disease testing, and that was not taken. And then the final thing I would like to add is that the public health lab facility is a major issue. We've been in the same place at Portland State University since 1997, and it is not only now out of date, but also the lease expires. Actually, it has expired. There's been an extension, but it will expire again on June 30th, 2003, and Portland State University has notified us that instead of extending that lease, they are planning on having us leave, although they will give us some leeway in when we have to get out. And that has been raised to both DAS and the department, and they're working on it, but I thought that you should know about that.
This may be a good place for us to stop, since we'll have a floor session in a minute, and we will schedule tomorrow to finish up after full ways meet. If there's no further questions, we are adjourned.